Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In her new book, As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock, today's guest, Dina Jilia Whitaker, writes that it's no surprise that the movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline would spring up in Indian country. The pipeline was just one more assault on the lands, resources, and self-determination of Native peoples since the beginning of American settler colonialism. The solidarity expressed by other communities and movements with the water protectors at Standing Rock illustrates a growing trend of environmental and indigenous movements joining together because of a growing recognition that in some ways what happened to the Indians is now happening to the 99%. In her new book, Dina Jilia Whitaker examines the history of the environmental justice movement, including how at times it has participated in the violation of Indigenous self-determination. She also explores how Native and non-Native groups are working together, building partnerships to build a more sane future. So what does environmental justice look like when Indigenous peoples are at the center? Dina Jilia Whitaker is a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes. She's a lecturer of American Indian Studies at California State University, San Marcos. She's also an independent consultant, an educator on environmental justice issues. She spent Thanksgiving weekend at Standing Rock on assignment from Indian Country Today. She also works to diversify and decolonize surfing. She's co-author with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Her new book is As Long as Grass Grows. And Dina Jilia Whitaker joins us from Irvine, California. Hi, Dina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great.
I'm super happy to be here.
Well, I'm great. I'm happy to have you. And thank you so much for writing this book. I really enjoyed reading it. Before we dive in and talk about the book, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? You grew up in Southern California. It's what people call, quote, urban Indian. Just tell us a little bit about you and how you got to this place of becoming an Indigenous scholar.
So I call myself, kind of recently it came up for me to call myself this, as a termination baby, which means that my mother, who was an enrolled tribal member of the Colville Confederated Tribes and had grown up there in Washington State on the reservation, had come during those years of termination. And for people who don't know what termination was, it was a period of history during the 1950s and 1960s, and really going back to the 1940s when it was first conceived, that the United States would finally solve its Indian problem. And solving the Indian problem basically meant getting rid of its trust responsibility. And so the way that they did this was by creating these programs that would basically empty Indians off the reservations. And one of the ways that they did this was by creating a jobs program that sent thousands and thousands and thousands of Native people from the reservations to large cities. And so this wave of migration that happened during these years, my mom came to L.A. from Washington as a result of these, you know, and it had everything to do with poverty, you know, and these horribly oppressive policies of the federal government. So she came to L.A., met my dad, and that's how I came to be. And so I grew up in Los Angeles as part of, in a really, really diverse community in East Los Angeles, actually. So it was really confusing to grow up as a mixed blood Native person away from my own tribal cultural orientation. So I had to kind of come back to it. I had to figure out how to understand myself in these larger historical contexts and processes. And even though I didn't have a language for that, now as an older person, as somebody who's a Native scholar, I have the language to be able to understand it and to explain it. So it was just a process of over years and years and decades, really, of maturing as a person that I was able to kind of understand why my family had gone through the things that it had gone through and came to these, you know, this horrible process, dysfunctions that Native people often know, like alcoholism, things like that, that I had to learn what all that was about. I had to learn a history that I was never taught and that had been really carefully concealed. So once I learned that history about my families, and that this involved boarding schools and the trauma that was inflicted by it, then I sort of became just committed to understanding that history and educating not just myself but other people. And so I did that in a bunch of different ways, and finally now it's really as a writer and as a teacher. So it's just sort of like a calling, I guess.
When did you learn about your history and about the history of this country? Just listening to you, it really struck me. Over the weekend, I was at the Bay Area Book Festival, and it was fantastic because they had a couple panels on Native issues, including transracial adoption. And at the end, there were a number of Native youth who read poetry and read stories about their families. And I asked them, what do you all learn in school? And do you ever stand up and say, actually, that's not the right story about Christopher Columbus? And they all got excited and said, oh my gosh, we learn hardly anything. It's still the old-fashioned mission story. They say that Christopher Columbus discovered America, and we all stand up. And it's just 2019, and this is what they're still learning in school today. And this is in California.
Yeah, I know. It's shocking, really. But studies have shown, you know, unequivocally that is the state of especially K through 12 education, that overwhelmingly, and this was a study I'm referring to specifically that Roxanne and I wrote about in our first book, the study that happened in 2015, where it was pretty extensive, where they looked at the teaching standards of all 50 states, and what it showed was that overwhelmingly those standards, they present Native peoples in a pre-1900 context. So effectively, this is a process of erasing Native people. So Native people are seen as basically extinct and certainly no longer relevant or vibrant, you know, existing communities.
On Facebook recently, you wrote about one of the exercises in one of your classes where students were a mock tribal council tasked with a decision whether or not to accept oil and gas production on their lands. And you said that after class, one of the non-Native students came up to you and said, how do you deal with it, the anger? How do you forgive all that's been done to your people? And you wrote, my response was, I don't believe in forgiveness. I believe in justice. You write that at your age, you've learned that to live with the ongoing colonization, you just have to keep working for justice.
Yeah. It's really true. And this is what I love about teaching, you know, these moments of clarity and sort of, it's catalytic. And I just love that student had the presence of mind to acknowledge that. And I know that it's really hard. I mean, most of the students that I teach are non-Native. I have quite a few Native students, but because we teach in an area that's mostly non-Native, but it's really diverse, too. I mean, we're like a Hispanic-serving institution. But these students, they're already sort of predisposed to understand these broader histories and kind of the ways these histories erase them and misrepresent them. Yeah, and so this is what I love about teaching, is that I'm able to bring these perspectives, and they're always shocking to students when they learn about, you know, the extent of genocide and land dispossession and the ongoing violation of Native rights that, you know, as I write about in the book, are increasingly affecting everybody, not just Native people. But the students are, you know, there's sort of a like a righteous indignation that I notice. It's sort of a pattern where they're so angry. They're angry that they've been miseducated, like everybody. I mean, everybody's miseducated, you know, especially when it comes to the narratives about the founding of the country and, you know, all the American exceptionalism that is, you know, woven throughout these patriotic narratives that we're all so used to. But they kind of get that they're being BS'd, you know, and they're not happy about it. So I think that, you know, we definitely have to get them younger so that they have a clearer vision about what this country is. Mm. But, you know, it's all about creating patriotic, loyal citizens, you know, more than it is about creating critical thinkers.
Where do you see us right now? Because, you know, I'm always so excited when I learn about new books like yours, As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice, From Colonization to Standing Rock. I feel like there's so many new books coming out right now by Native writers and then also non-Native writers. You've talked about the two recent books about the history of California's genocide. It feels to me like there's just this explosion of new books coming out. You know, Native Twitter is so incredibly active that especially young people are saying, you know what, this is our story and we want to be part of the conversation.
I agree. I'm really struck also by the amount of books, not just the amount of books that are coming out by Native writers and scholars and other literary kind of people, but the quality of the books that are coming out is pretty amazing. And, you know, I'm tempted to think that, you know, there's maybe a critical mass, maybe we're at some kind of moment, historical moment, that there's a rupture that's open. And I do think that that's the case to some degree, that I think, you know, if you go back to 2016 with the election of Trump and how that was so shocking, and we've had this, you know, in the last 2.5-3 years now, we've seen this uptick in racist, you know, and hate crimes and all this, you know, hate speech and all the stuff that we're dealing with, as difficult and negative as that is, on the other hand, it's really kind of created an opening for us to be able to have these conversations, these really honest conversations about just how unsettled all of these topics are. You know, we're not living in the post-racial state. We're not, we haven't reached equality just because we had 8 years of a black president. And then, of course, Standing Rock showed us that that the incursions and the violation of Native rights is just a matter of routine in this country. Mm. And I think that was a real wake-up call for people who didn't understand, you know, if they were watching social media, they were watching those live feeds of dogs attacking people and water cannons spraying, you know, water in sub-freezing temperatures, which in effect is a lethal form of weaponization in that context. And, you know, these radical human rights violations that were happening, I think that people that, you know, like especially non-Native people that weren't so aware of these things, like Indian country is, these kinds of battles that we're still fighting, I think that it was shocking to them. And so it created even more of an opening to have, again, these honest conversations that we need to have in this country.
Today we're speaking with Dina Gilio Whitaker, author of As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice, From Colonization to Standing Rock. Dina is lecturer of American Indian Studies at California State University, San Marcos, and is a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments for Dina about, I mean, there's so much. You know, I'm just so glad that we have an hour to really dive into these issues. We talk about Native issues on a regular basis on this show, about history, where we are today, about indigenizing the environmental movement. So if you have any thoughts about that, or if you'd like to ask Dina any questions, I mean, her book really, it's not just about Standing Rock. I mean, it's From Colonization to Standing Rock, and it goes in depth about so many historical issues. So if you have any questions or comments for Dina, we'd love to hear from you. And if you'd like to talk about just the shift in the conversation about environmental justice since Standing Rock, you can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dina, as you point out in the book, and I just said, this is not specifically about Standing Rock, but it takes, as you write, it takes Standing Rock as an excellent example of what environmental justice in Indian country looks like. And one of the main questions in the book is, what does environmental justice look like when Indigenous peoples are at the center? Can you talk about how you went about really exploring and answering that question?
So, okay, that's a big conversation. But it begins with the chapter on, there's a chapter in the book on sacred sites. And that came as a result of a master's thesis that I did on that had to do with the protection of a sacred site here in Orange County where I live. And Orange County is not a place that's known for, you know, a large Native population. There are no federally recognized tribes. There's no reservations. So it was sort of an odd site for a conversation like this to emerge. But it was a really important site because of the fact, perhaps because that the tribe in question, the Ahashman people, are not federally recognized, but they were fighting for the protection of a sacred site that was part of an ancient village site that's documented to be at least 9,600 years old. And so I did the study about how the site was protected thanks to the Coastal Commission, who recognized the importance of that site. But that site really kind of exemplifies why Native sacred sites are, especially that are not trust lands or reservation lands, have met with such a difficulty getting protected, like the San Francisco Peaks case being the kind of the most obvious example. And that's because federal law has no way of recognizing indigenous worldviews as being really different and thus worthy of being incorporated into law to protect these sites from abuse and, you know, lack of access. So it started there. And it just grew into, like, how do we think through what does it mean, what does environmental justice really mean for Native people? Mm-hmm. That means you have to deconstruct it, go back to the beginning of environmental justice policy and history in this country, which really only goes back in the literature to, like, the early 1980s, and it comes out of the Deep South with Black communities protecting themselves or, you know, attempting to protect themselves from the siting of these noxious facilities, these toxic waste dumps. And so in those days, the studies came out of communities, and the communities suspected there was this thing called environmental racism, and that environmental racism meant that they were being that communities of color were being targeted for these facilities, the siting of these facilities. And so that has been, you know, written into federal law and federal policy with the passing of Executive Order 12898 in 1992, but by President Clinton, and some laws that have passed since then and other policy frameworks that rest on this idea of environmental racism. But when you look at it through the lens of settler colonialism, it's really beyond racism. That's what I argue in the book, that for Native people, the problems of land dispossession and the ongoing incursions into Native territories by extractive industries like the Dakota Access Pipeline, which went through unceded Lakota territory, is really about it's about understanding these much broader frameworks that go beyond racism. That are all about, you know, understanding this through a lens of domination and looking at federal Indian law as the mechanism of domination that still ongoingly plays itself out in Indian country, and that until these mechanisms and these processes aren't addressed, then, you know, talking about environmental racism and environmental justice is not going to really do Native people any good, especially in places where, like the Hoshiman territory and the sacred site in Orange County and the San Francisco Peaks and other, you know, countless other places that we can name, you know, will not be able to receive adequate protection. So understanding this, that justice is beyond the concept of racism for Native people.
And this is important because you write that the way that the laws are constructed do not consider Indigenous people's relationship to the land and definitely don't consider the history of genocide. So this is really important because when you say environmental justice has to be indigenized, I'm guessing a lot of people are saying, well, what does that mean exactly? But then when you take it further and say, well, look at the laws, they just don't consider Indigenous people's relationships to land. Then I think people say, aha, that makes sense.
Yeah, that, and when you look at the foundation of federal Indian law with things like the doctrine of discovery, which I imagine you've talked about on your program at one time or another, but the doctrine of discovery being like the foundation for federal Indian law, which is this about the justification of European cultural and religious superiority over Indigenous peoples. And so, again, that goes beyond race. This is about white supremacy coded in a different way. So it's cultural and religious superiority is how it plays out for Native people. And then all the other, you know, like the plenary power doctrine that comes out of the late 1800s, where the Supreme Court affirms that Congress has always had the power to abrogate treaties and, you know, other legal doctrines that, you know, the doctrine of domestic dependent nationhood that was part of the Marshall Trilogy, that force Native nations into this relationship of subjugation without their consent. So that's this structure of domination. And then, as you said, this, you know, the very different in academic speak, we would say the epistemological framework or the world views of Native people and their very different relationship to land, which is about understanding the land as a relative, you know, through this lens of relationality and respect and reciprocity and responsibility, which is, you know, obviously not a suite of values that Western culture holds, you know, in their own understanding of land and their relationship to it. So yeah, we have to be able to incorporate all of that, and it's really for all of us. We all have to begin to have a different kind of relationship to land and place if we're going to survive this, you know, this age of the Anthropocene, as it's sometimes called. If we're to, you know, survive.
Today we're speaking with Dina Gilio Whitaker. She's author of As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. And in her book, she argues that modern environmentalists must look to the history of Indigenous resistance, which she writes about from colonization to Standing Rock, for inspiration in our common fight for a just and sustainable future. She also examines the ongoing ecocide against Native people and the tensions between these communities and the mainstream environmental movement. Dina Gilio Whitaker is lecturer of American Indian Studies at California State University, Marcos. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Dina Gilio Whitaker about her new book, As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. Dina is a lecturer of American Indian Studies at California State University, San Marcos, and she's a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes. And if you have any questions or comments for Dina, if you'd like to talk about the environmental movement and what has really changed in that conversation since Standing Rock, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you work in the environmental movement and you have any comments about this, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You know, Dina, I want to spend a little more time talking about the land, because I think this is so important. In the book that you co-wrote with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, you wrote it from the perspective of settler colonialism. And you write about that in your new book also. And in many talks you've given, you say that settler colonialism is always and always has been about the acquisition of land. And I feel like even in, you know, very progressive conversations about the environment and where we are right now, it seems like the land is missing oftentimes. So can you talk about that and just why it's so important to really spend a lot of time focusing about the historical, you know, taking of the land?
Yeah, I think that it's the irreducible factor in all of these conversations that when you take it all the way down, settler colonialism is about and this is from the work of Patrick Wolfe. I'm not the one who said it, but you know, he articulated it this way, you know, years ago, and it really is, it makes so much sense. And so it's really sort of the foundation that we do and that we work from in Native studies. But in the U.S., in this country, we're talking about, you know, a system where private property is worshipped, right? It's fetishized. It's written into our federal constitution. It's the one thing that the founders of the Constitution of the United States, you know, wanted to protect. And as we know, the protection of property rights was really about protection for white male citizens, right, at that time. And so it boils down to capitalism and understanding land as a property and something that you own, and that's a different kind of relationship. And you know, people still, it constructed this whole American dream narrative, right? And the American dream is about owning your own piece of the pie, right? A piece of the land, a house that you can live on. And that's still very much at the center of Americanness and American identity. And that's the one thing people don't want to question, right? If what it means to live in the United States is to have a piece of that pie, like, it's unspeakable to think about what it means to be part of that system that was so fundamentally unjust to begin with, right? The founding of a country on stolen land and on genocide. What does that mean? What does that mean for people today, right? If we're looking at it as something that's not just something that happened in the past, but something that continues to reinscribe itself on top of indigenous lands, what is that? What are the implications of that for everybody? And that's what we don't have a conversation about in this country. It's easier to talk about racism than it is to talk about what does it mean to live in a country of stolen land. So you know, I think that for where I'm going with my work is wanting to really look at that. And I work with my students in this class that I'm teaching on that you referred to earlier, on traditional environmental ecological knowledge, and you know, teaching them about what a different relationship to land looks like beyond the Eurocentric, you know, private property, you know, capitalist view of what land means in this context. But what do you know about the land where you live? What do you know about the people that came before you and that are still there? Because Native people, part of that narrative is that Native people are gone, right? That's why this conversation about erasure and teaching people that Native people are still here, genocide was not totally successful, right? It wiped out, yeah, a lot of people, but we did survive and we are still here. Even non-federally recognized tribes, like you have where you are in the Bay Area and like where I'm at in Orange County, just because they're not federally recognized tribes doesn't mean they're not still there and holding it down with their own communities and perpetuating their cultures. So I've been kind of referring to this as the colonial unspeakable, you know, that and other scholars are writing about it in terms of the colonial unknowing, like, you know, the way that land is rendered and genocide is rendered unintelligible in these American narratives. So I think that's the next big conversation that needs to be had if we are to talk about what environmental justice really means for Native people.
And as you point out, forest removals like the Trail of Tears are somewhat widely known, but there are so many other forest removals. And I really appreciated that you looked at what is known in Pomo oral histories as the Death March, in which several Pomo groups in coastal Northern California were marched to a reservation in what is now Mendocino County, where they were subjected to hunger, rape, and kidnapping into the slave trade. My grandmother was Pomo, and her people barely made it out. I mean, very few survived. And you know, I think about this a lot because so many people come to California to travel to these places, the wine country, Mendocino, and yet there's hardly any exhibit, statue, what have you, to tell people about what actually happened in this beautiful place that people come to visit.
I know. It's shocking. It's amazing how little is written about the Pomo Death March. And I think this is an area that's ripe for scholarship. As you said, it's well known in oral histories. It wasn't that long ago. And I'm sure that there are other similar events in the United States. I mean, I still keep learning of forced removals that I've never heard of, but I learned about it because I had lived in Sonoma County for almost 20 years, and I was friends with many people in the Pomo community and the Miwok community. I think I want to go back to this idea of, like, what does it mean to be in land and place? What is your relationship to land and place? And so it's about, like, instilling an ethic or enacting an ethic about what it means to be a settler or a guest in somebody else's homelands. And I apply that to myself, even as a Native person, because as a Native person, as somebody who is indigenous to Turtle Island, to this continent, I am still, because I'm not living in my own homelands, I'm still a guest in somebody else's homelands. And so I apply this logic to myself. And what does it mean for me to enact a relationship of responsibility to the land and to the indigenous people? And so that's part of what I try to do in this, in my work. And it began with, you know, becoming sort of a guerrilla journalist when I was living in Sonoma County and writing about the horrible experience that the Federated, Federated Indians of the Great Rancheria, their horrible casino battle that they fought, you know, about 20 years ago. Less than 20 years ago, actually. I was there in the middle of all of that, and living in Sonoma County, which, you know, I had thought of at the time was this really wonderful liberal community. Well, it turns out they're not so liberal and open-minded when it came to Indian stuff, because all this horrible anti-Indianism emerged during that time period, and it really, you know, as I write about that in the book, it's really it harkens back to this horrible California history where genocide was perhaps the most pronounced if you look at you know, the broader histories and the way violence was enacted on the land in such an extreme and profound way in this state. And that's something that really hasn't been accounted for yet in this country's history. But I think we're starting to see a movement in that direction with some of these books. You mentioned Benjamin Madley, Brendan Lindsay's book, Murder State, was a good one. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were other scholars who laid the foundation for them years before that, Native scholars. So I think that, you know, I think that's part of this bigger kind of movement or energy that's happening in this country that is really, I would argue, the result of Native scholarship in the last 50 to 60 years.
Well, as you said, you're always learning, and I appreciate your work because I learned so much from your book. You write that with the creation of the Death Valley National Monument in 1933, the Timbisha Shoshone in California were dispossessed of their lands and forced to end their ancient land management practices. Decades of landscape neglect resulted in the deterioration of the honey mesquite and single-leaf pinyon groves, which were important food sources. You write that the Timbisha requested co-management with the Park Service, but they faced bitter opposition from individuals and environmental groups, including the Sierra Club. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so that goes back to you know, the early history of, you know, sort of the proto-environmental movement in this country that begins with the conservation and preservation movement in the 19th century and the setting up of the national park system. And, you know, this idea of, you know, the national parks being America's greatest idea, the way it's been lauded, you know, throughout these narratives, American narratives. But that, you know, ultimately, this proto-environmental movement, and you know, we talk about the writing of environmental history, it really begins with that. And this much less known history of the preservation and conservation movement really being rooted in indigenous land dispossession. Mm-hmm. And California, again, California is this place that is such a rich site of analysis to look at that, especially with Yosemite, Yosemite. Mm-hmm. I always get Yellowstone and Yosemite kind of crossed up in my mind. Mm-hmm. But Yosemite Valley is this place that you know, was an enactment of intense violence against the people there, the Awanichi Miwok, as they're referred to, who had made the valley their home for hundreds and hundreds of years and who managed that landscape. So it's part of, again, this kind of one of the exceptionalist narratives in American history is that Native people, you know, lived on the land. They really didn't use the land, you know, correctly according to European standards, and that they didn't they left the nature untouched, that they didn't intervene on their landscapes. And that's one of the huge myths that turns out not to be true, because there's lots and lots of evidence and documentation about how Native people actually did manipulate their landscapes and their environments for a whole lot of different reasons, ranging from you know, creating an abundant food sources for them in game, to managing landscapes for you know, limiting the wildfires, especially here in California. You know, we see these massive wildfires these days, and it's directly as a result of the lack of management, the way that Native people did them for thousands of years here. They understood that when you let nature grow wild and forests to grow untended, then it creates these conditions for super-fueled fires. So they controlled this problem with cultural burning. So all these things are connected. And you know, going back to your original question about the Timbisha Shoshone and these co-management agreements, it was something that the Sierra Club, members of the Sierra Club, did not understand. They were fully bought into the previous myths of, you know, an untended landscape, and they didn't believe that Native people had the capacity to go back to these traditional practices. I don't think that they understood that there were such traditional practices. So yeah, it's about how this white supremacy and, you know, European, you know, how Europeans have always thought of themselves as knowing better. And so that plays out in the environmental movement, beginning with the establishment of the national parks. Mm-hmm. And so we see that legacy in the environmental movement today. And I think less so, you know, and I'm, you know, fortunately, I think that there's finally starting to be a listening to Native people about this, these problems, and you know, and that's evidenced in the building alliances and coalitions of the environmental movement and organizations with Native people. But I think that all that white supremacy is not completely gone yet, and that's why I write about that in the book with the chapter on women and women's roles.
Dina Gilio Whitaker is author of As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. Dina is lecturer of American Indian Studies at California State University, San Marcos. And if you have any questions or comments for Dina, we've got about 5 more minutes, so not much time, but you can give us a call, 866-798-8255, or email yourcall@kalw.org. We're almost out of time, Dina, and we're going to have you back because I'd love to do a whole show on just Native women. As you write that, you know, they didn't have to fight for equality because they had gender equality. And women and youth really started the Standing Rock movement. But because we're short on time, since you brought up today's movement and we're seeing just so much, I mean, as you write, it didn't start with Standing Rock. We have Idle No More. I mean, you can take it back even further than that. But the Indigenous Environmental Network. Now we're seeing so many students striking on Fridays. I mean, this is just an explosive movement. And I was really touched during the last march when Native women were in front wearing red, not only, you know, saying that we need to indigenize this movement, but we also need to recognize missing and murdered Indigenous women. So what are your thoughts about the movement today? And do you think that it is truly embracing Indigenous peoples? Do you think that Indigenous peoples are truly at the center of this movement, not just brought in for the one Native speaker, but really, really have a seat at the table?
Well, I guess you'd have to look at that on a case-by-case basis. I think that there's lip service paid to that. I don't know, you know, that when I look back on the Women's March that happened during the presidential inauguration, I didn't see a centering of women's voices there. Mm. I think that and there were huge problems around you know, the intersectionality of these different types of feminisms, and a lot of calling out of the organizers. You know, it exposed the shortcomings of the feminist movement even today. So I think that there are some places where it's happening, you know, and Native women are centered in these movements, or at least given a strong voice. I think it needs to happen more frequently, and you know, I like to think that we have a growing awareness about it, but and I think there is a growing awareness about it, but I think it needs to be even more. So yeah, and I'm definitely noticing, especially in the last few weeks, there's more press about the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm noticing that there are legislation being passed about it at the state level. I think at the federal level, it's still a problem because of the people in charge. But it does seem to be an issue that's gaining steam. And, you know, hopefully it's not just the issue du jour, and that it'll go away in a few weeks, you know, once the kind of the flash of it dies down. But Yeah, there's a lot we could talk about.
Yeah,
it's a huge topic.
It's huge, and we'd love to have you back. And I hate to ask you another huge question, but these are such massive topics. And it's because I think for so many people, you know, we're learning about a lot of this for the first time, at least in this way. And so given all of the new amazing books that are coming out, you know, High Country News now has an Indigenous desk, which is fantastic. I mean, there's so much more work that needs to be done, but...
Kudos to Tristan Autone over there.
Yeah. From a practical standpoint, you know, someone who is involved in environmental justice issues, when you say we need to indigenize the environmental justice movement, how should people think about that?
Well, you know, again, it goes back to we need to advocate for a rewriting of Indigenous of environmental justice policy and frameworks. You know, I argue in the book that we could start with rewriting Executive Order 12898 to include language that reflects Indigenous, you know, the history of colonization and genocide and, I mean, Indigenous relationships to land. And I want to say that in California, you know, it's been pretty remarkable. There's some pretty progressive stuff happening here in this state, and I think it's worthy of mentioning that the California Coastal Commission is such a site where we're seeing the beginnings of an indigenizing of environmental justice policy, and it's with the environmental justice policy that they just finished writing, and so. In that policy framework, they do have a distinct tribal environmental justice policy framework. And what they did was they went out and they collected comments from the native public. And some of us had contributed, you know, comments that said that, you know, and I personally, what I said was that if you did nothing else in this languaging of this policy framework, at least acknowledge California's history of genocide and colonization. And, you know, just for a beginning point, so that you can talk about other things from there. And surprisingly enough, in the final version of that bill, they actually did incorporate that language and they left it in there. Hmm. So it's something that you can look up. I think it's precedent setting, and I think it's something that can be looked to by other states and other kinds of municipalities. So it really represents a beginning, I think, a beginning point of, you know, accounting for this larger history that we can then have different conversations about what it means to indigenize environmental justice policy or other policies, too, for that matter.
Dina Jillia Whitaker is a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes and author of As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice, From Colonization to Standing Rock. Dina, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you. It was great.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.